welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Welcome, 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 my friends, to another live installment of the one and only political cesspool radio program. As always, it's my privilege and pleasure to serve as the host of this show that you have made a hit. It's Saturday, January 23rd, 2010. As you know, it's a new year with no limits in the political cesspool. I'm your host, James Edwards, and we've got another great program lined up for you tonight. Joining me this first hour, as always, my good friend and Confederate, Keith Alexander. Keith, how are you tonight, sir?
Doing great, and Confederate in more ways than one, right?
Well, you've got that right, Keith, and I tell you, I'm really excited about the program tonight. One of the many reasons I'm excited is because you're on here this evening, and you know, I got to tell the listeners how fluid being the host of this program can be. You just really got to be ready to roll with the punches. Earlier this week, we had a phenomenal show lined up. The second hour was going to feature Jared Taylor, the editor of American Renaissance magazine. In the third hour, Eddie the Bombardier Miller was going to come in studio, and we were going to host interview Officer Jack McLam, who is the highest decorated police officer in the history of the city of Phoenix, Arizona. So we had the show planned out, second and third hour. Keith was on for the first hour. Well, about midweek, realized that we had to reschedule Jared Taylor for a later week. There was a scheduling conflict. Then just yesterday, Eddie the Bombardier was grounded, pun intended, as he had severe laryngitis, so he lost his voice. We had to scrap the third hour. I called Winston Smith. That's why we have so many great co-hosts, indispensable. We call Winston up. He's ready to roll tonight with me in the second and third hour. We got Reverend Ted Pike on now. He's always in season. So, Keith, you know, another day, another dollar. You just you come up to an obstacle and you hurdle it. That's all you do.
Well, we just roll the punches. You know, we never know from day to day or minute to minute what's going to happen on this show. So, you know, I think, quite frankly, that's part of our charm.
Well, one of the many charming things, characteristics I do believe we possess, and God knows no one does it better than we are. We're the biggest, we're the best, and the listening audience is responsible for that. And, of course, all the great guests. And we'll get Jared, we'll get Officer McLam. But tonight, just to set the record straight, we do have Reverend Ted Pike on. He's going to anchor the program as our featured guest of the evening. That's why there on the website, under the forthcoming guest, in fine print, you'll see schedule subject to change. But we're still going to have a great show. A show every bit as good, Keith, as the tour we had of Memphis, Tennessee on Thursday. You got to tell the audience a little bit about that.
Well, I got a phone call from you again, kind of a last-minute thing, which, of course, is expected. So we had a guest coming into town, and James likes to take tours of Memphis, places that, you know, are not in the normal itinerary of the tour guide industry here in Memphis, but places that we like and we think are significant. And James likes me usually to conduct those, so I get a call and we do it. And quite frankly, we can make these things up on the spur of the moment, depending on what part of town we're in, tailor them to whatever time parameters we have. And I think we had a successful one with this special guest we had on Thursday, don't you?
Well, absolutely, Keith. It's always intriguing. You know, I've lived here all my life, all 30 years of my existence. Well, I'll be 30 in June. So for all my life, I've lived in Memphis, so I know the town. But Keith Alexander never ceases to amaze me by taking me into little pockets of the city that I had never known before. And that's an understatement. You never know where you're going to end up when you take one of Keith Alexander's world-famous tours. And we like to give these tours to visiting dignitaries that are in town for different events. We've given it to Dr. Tom Sunick. We had a great time with Tom last summer. We've given it to different guests we've had that have come into Memphis for interviews in studio. Typically, obviously, with our guests who call in from all over the world, they're able to hook up with us via satellite. But sometimes they do come into Memphis for in-studio interviews, and anytime we have something like that happen, we make sure we roll out the red carpet and give them the tour. Keith Alexander serves as tour guide. Well, this week we had a young man from New York. He's been a fan of this program for, well, almost since its inception. He began listening, I believe he said, in 2005. So for nearly the entire run of this show, this gentleman had been listening. And he just graduated from college, and he has been awarded an internship at a very prestigious conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. But before making the trip to Washington, he wanted to drive out of his way all the way to Memphis just to spend a little time with us. And we just had a great day with him. And we really appreciate and respect the working relationship and friendships that we share with the listeners of this program. This is a young man who told us over lunch on Thursday that our program has positively impacted his life, and it's because of our show in part that he has embarked upon a life of conservative political activism. So, Keith, truly, our work could mean nothing more. There's nothing more we could do in our capacities as hosts of this program than to have that sort of impact, and hopefully this young gentleman will go on and have an impact far greater than our own. I mean, that's really what we're here for, and it's just very heartwarming and enriching to know that this show reaches people that way.
Yeah, I think it has a lot of influence, and much more so than I'm sure that our adversaries would like to admit. And, of course, there's nothing that fleshes out and gives credence to our opinions like a tour of Memphis. You know, it's I think Thomas Wolfe, the author from North Carolina back in the 30s, wrote a short story called Only the Dead Know Brooklyn. Well, only the cesspool staff knows Memphis, and we know it like the back of our hand. And it's basically everything that we talk about you can illustrate with a drive through Memphis. You know, Memphis, the decline of Memphis, the Memphis of 1950 versus the Memphis of today, is quite frankly something that is constantly before us. And because of that, it, you know, we're constantly provided with more and more material. Just for example, tell them about running into the panhandler.
Well, as I've always said, why give money to needy Haitians when we have disadvantaged South Memphians that could use our support? Yeah, you know, to put the cherry on the cake, to put the icing on the cake, at the end of Keith's 4-hour tour that we took on Thursday with our special visitor, we were going back to Nathan Bedford Forest Park, where the tour began, to get our cars, and we came up to a red light in the proverbial ghetto, and there was a black Memphian there, a typical Memphis citizen, and his cardboard box said, "I need a beer." Simply, "I need a beer." That's all it said. And Keith, you can tell him what happened after that.
Well, James was so impressed with this honest man, like Diogenes looking for an honest man. James is always looking for an honest man. And when he saw this, he was so moved to charity that he gave the man $3. He tried to get a photograph of him with the guest and with him, but the guest's cell phone camera wouldn't work. So I dropped him off because I had other things to do. And then they get in the car and promptly go back, and of course the guy's nowhere to be found, and I told James that's because he was absolutely dead serious and honest. He did want a beer, and when he got the money for a beer, he was gone to get one, and he was undoubtedly consuming it when you came back 5 minutes later.
Well, absolutely. We had facilitated that purchase, but I wanted to get a picture with him so I could prove, you know, to the SPLC that this is not hate-mongering radio. We care about other races, and we want to do them a solid. So I was going to get a picture, put it up on the blog. It just didn't work out, but I'm glad I could have not only played a positive role in the young man who was here to visit with us, but also in the gentleman that needed a beer. So philanthropy, charity all the way.
That's it. He just said he wanted it.
Yeah, he didn't. Yeah, well, that's right. There's a big difference between want and need, I guess. Two different words. But nevertheless, the moral of the story is, if you ever come to Memphis, email us. We just might take you on the world-famous Keith Alexander tour, and you'll see things you've never seen before. You'll fear for your life. You know, I told Keith, just before this tour is over, I want you to make me scared. And he took me through some areas of Memphis that were rough as a cob, as you like to say, Keith. I thought our vehicle was going to get riddled with Uzi spray. But nevertheless, we survived to live another day, and here we are tonight. And all that bantering aside, I guess we ought to get to the program. We've had a great month of January. We have really burst onto the new year with guns blazing. And tonight's going to be another episode in that same spirit. We've had Kevin McDonald, Hutton Gibson, Sam Dixon, and Gordon Baum, among others, as our guest. Ted Pike's going to be on a little later tonight. But before then, Keith and I have a lot, much more to talk about this hour, and we're going to get to it right after this. Stay tuned, everybody. We're just getting started.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, let's get down to brass tacks, shall we? Let's get down to business. I do always like starting out the show, though, with a little friendly chat and banter. I think it's a good way to, you know, just get everybody in and then get them seated at the table, and then we go into the more pressing affairs of state. Although I do have two quick announcements before we move forward. Don't forget, and we made mention of this last week, the email system is fixed. We had so much email correspondence coming in that it temporarily crashed a couple of weeks ago. You want to email us, go to thepoliticalcesspool.org. That's our internet headquarters, www.thepoliticalcesspool.org. Go to the contact page, and you can email yours truly or any of the cesspool hosting staff. Also, we want to encourage you to join our Facebook page, and there's a link to that on our widely read blog. All that and more at thepoliticalcesspool.org. Now, Keith, big news story this week, obviously the election of a Republican in Massachusetts. But as I said on the aforementioned blog, neocons and Tea Partiers alike are excited about the Scott Brown's victory in Massachusetts. But here in the political cesspool, not so much. I feel as though, Keith, and you feel free to agree or disagree with me, that Brown is just the newest quote-unquote good guy in the fixed wrestling match that politics has become. He won't get at the root of the real problems that are facing this country, and he's certainly no threat to the Wall Street, Hollywood, D.C., axis of evil. He knows what he can and can't say, and he always makes sure to stay between those lines, just like Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, and every other neocon fraud the Tea Party types always swoon over. Keith, what's your take on it?
Well, I think he's a second coming of Sarah Palin. Palin is the candidate that the Jewish establishment, the elite running this country, love to hate because she represents Red State America. She is a, the Christian, rural, and suburban white Gentiles that they fear so much, or apparently fear so much, in the elite cadre in America. Here we have the new manifestation, and finally, white male Gentiles are back in fashion. You know, they're trying to give us everybody but a white male Gentile for the longest time, and now another one has come up because they realize that the people have had their fill of the diversity of catalog that they keep marching in front of us. What I'm fearful of is that, again, what's the first thing that I see when I open the newspaper after his election, a picture of him posing with a big smile on his face, with his arm around none other than the chief neocon himself, John McCain. They're going to take him out, put him on the fundraising circuit, raising money for the Republican Party, and I can see a replay of 1994 where the reaction against all Democrats have to do is get into power and start ruling America, and people realize what a horrendous mistake it is to get these, you know, proto-Marxists into office. But then the Republicans are handed a wonderful opportunity like they were in 1994, like they were in 68 and a number of other elections. And what do? They squander it. They, who is the one person that you remember from that Contract with America era of 1994 that came in with the, you know, the Republican landslide that basically fizzled out and did nothing, none other than Newt Gingrich, another chief neocon, a philanderer, a man who was cheating on his wife while she was dying of cancer. What a role model we had there. And that guy is still hanging around in the wings trying to get involved in Republican politics. So you're right. You know, Scott Brown looks good now, but, you know, I just have the feeling that he's going to be co-opted just like Sarah Palin was. You know, as soon as Sarah Palin was named as a vice presidential candidate, the first thing that the neocons did was whisk her to New York so she could be grilled by AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee.
I'm glad you brought that up, Keith, because, and it should be mentioned, that the Scott Brown character is also deep in the pocket of AIPAC. He has come out, obviously, in favor of support of this radical Zionist lobbying group. But, you know, when it comes to the most critical issues of American nationalism, Scott Brown is not going to do anything to put America first. When it comes to the issues of foreign policy and America First foreign policy and America First trade policy, he's not going to advocate the reindustrialization of America's manufacturing base. He's not going to say, let's secure the border, let's stop illegal immigration. He's not going to say any of that. But I can also be fair, and he may play a role in the derailing of the Obama socialized healthcare policy. And if he does that, we will at least have to give him credit for that. And that's not to be discounted. But on the other most serious issues facing the American people, he's going to be a mainstream establishment Republican, and that is not a good thing.
Well, which means that he's subservient to Israeli and Jewish interests. And why are Israeli and Jewish interests, again, so bad? What's so bad about it? Well, again, we keep pointing back to the irrefutable fact that Jews are the most liberal segment of the white demographic in political elections. They vote 80% at least, and oftentimes higher, for the Democratic candidate for president. They are full-blown socialists, and they have this visceral distrust and dislike for the founding stock of America. And as members of the founding stock, we better start recognizing who doesn't like us and who is working to subvert us. And, of course, I don't know about Scott Brown's religion, but, of course, Sarah Palin is a fundamentalist Christian, which means that she has adopted and fully consumed the cup of Jewish dispensationalism, that false Christian doctrine that seems to be so popular among fundamentalist Christians now. Which means that, you know, the Jewish establishment can hate her, but if she comes actually into power, she's not going to do them any harm. I quite frankly don't know that much about the religion or lack of religion of Scott Brown, but I tell you what, I'm all ears.
Well, here's the bottom line, I guess, Keith. An excellent commentary provided by you, as always. You know, Scott Brown, it could be, you know, he's probably better than, slightly better than a kick in the teeth, but if conservative voters out there believe that we can lay down our swords, that America has now taken a sharp turn to the right because of his election, you know, you better think again. So the bottom line is, don't expect much. There's still much to be accomplished. Scott Brown's not going to be a savior for our people in any way. But Keith, Obama,
even if he was, all his election does is prevent the Congress from being filibuster-proof. They can now filibuster, but quite frankly, they can't win, and the filibuster can't go on forever. The Obamacare thing, quite frankly, has turned out to be a game-changer for Obama because the people of America thought that what he was going to do was just put some regulations on health care, put some restrictions on how much hospitals and drug companies and doctors could charge for their services. Instead, he's used this desire to somehow rein in the healthcare sector into a mandate to come and put in socialized medicine, you know, a la Cuba style or a la Swedish style. And, of course, that's not going to work in America because we have a heterogeneous population, a lot of blacks, a lot of Hispanics, but a majority of whites, and it's basically going to come down to a wealth transfer between the white population and the non-white population, And people don't like that. You know, I like the, we were talking about a comment attributed to Alan Greenspan, who was being lectured on socialism by the premier of Sweden some time ago, and he said, here in Sweden, we don't have an unemployment problem. To which Greenspan, who's, you know, a Jewish financial mogul here in America, the, you know, the head of the Fed and whatnot for the longest time, he turned to him and said, you know, in America, we don't have a Swedish unemployment problem either.
Keith, with that, we got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Political Cesspool, guys. We'll be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll free at 1-866-986-6397.
Welcome back to the show. Welcome back to the Political Cesspool radio program. James Edwards here with you from AM 1380 WLRM Radio Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, our flagship station, but not our only affiliate, thanks to the Liberty News Radio Network, Liberty News Radio.com, and to our internet and satellite audiences as well. Thank you for tuning in this 23rd night of January 2010. Keith, in the previous segment before the break, we were talking about Obamacare and the socialist manifestations that it carries. It's going to be interesting in just a moment when we compare and contrast the Michael King, a.k.a. Martin Luther King Jr., economic policy that he was advocating in the 60s. It seems as though the socialists and communists of our country have maintained a very steady course over the past 4 and 5 decades. But Keith, a final word on Obamacare.
Well, the thing on Obamacare is this. We keep hearing about 47 million uninsured in America, and I will bet you my bottom dollar that 47 million of uninsured Americans is disproportionately black and Hispanic. And
why
course,
is that, Keith? Is it because we have a racist health care system that doesn't like to provide coverage to them?
No, it's because medical care is expensive, and you have to either get it yourself or you have to have a job and keep a job that has those type of benefits. And, you know, there's just a disparity that's existed there because of a intelligence disparity, because of a work ethic disparity, that shows that there are more black people in poverty. And, you know, to continue to blame this on racism when we've had over 40 years of affirmative action, efforts to boost prospects of black and Hispanic and other American Indians, people like this, and their employment prospects, despite at the expense of a meritocracy, because if we had a meritocracy, white Gentiles, quite frankly, would be doing extremely well. They would be getting these jobs, and other people wouldn't, as the blacks and Hispanics wouldn't, as the test results for the fire department in New Haven, Connecticut showed in that recent Supreme Court case, in which all the promotions went to the white firefighters and not to the minority firefighters. That's why it is. This is a way to get around that, to just start providing care for everybody. And of course, the people that are going to get the predominant benefit from that are non-whites, and that's why the Jewish establishment, who sees the white, Gentile, Christian, rural, suburban population as their enemy, is supporting it in the way that they are, and they are. So, you know, that's all there is to that. But, you know, you were talking about Martin Luther King, and it was really impressive what I saw recently. I saw something on the Glenn Beck show, and he was quoting Julian Bond, who's one of the old war horses of the NAACP, who stated publicly on the radio that Martin Luther King was really, what he had in mind was a modified sort of socialism for the United States, but he was a socialist and a Marxist. And of course, we on the right are always hearing claptrap from mainstream conservatives to the effect that Martin Luther King was this great individualist who, you know, wanted people to be judged by the content of their character and not by their color. Well, according to the left, and I tend to believe the left, that's a bunch of baloney. He wasn't that way at all. He was actually a socialist and was working for socialism.
Well, the fact that he was, in many circles, it's believed, an avowed communist is not something that's actually news after all these decades. It was almost common knowledge back in the 60s before the brainwashing began and the reinterpretation of his life began. But, you know, we read here, obviously, the big Michael King Day, and I prefer to call him by his real name, not the name he gave himself. But the big Michael King Day holiday a couple of days ago, of course, he was front page news in Memphis. And it talked about his economic policy, Keith, and people will think we're exaggerating if they didn't read the story. I don't know if that was a story that was unique to the commercial appeal here in Memphis, the local daily fish wrap, or if that was an Associated Press story. But either way, you can look it up. Tell people what King was advocating with regards to a domestic economic policy back in his day in the 60s.
Well, he, according to the black editor of the Communist Appeal, as we call it here, his actual name is Commercial Appeal, what King wanted was a guaranteed minimum income pegged not at the poverty level, not at the minimum wage level, but at the median, in other words, middle level. In other words, everybody, this is going to be like Lake Wobegon. Everybody in America is going to be above average, or at least average. And how are you going to do this? It's going to be a crushing burden of taxation on people that are above the average. Basically, it's just going to be confiscation. And this is what Martin Luther King wanted. This is what the left-wing editor of the Memphis Commercial Appeal trumpeted on the front page. And, of course, it all goes like water off a duck's back over these movement conservatives and Republican poobahs. They just keep going like this information doesn't exist and that their fantasy creation of Martin Luther King, the content of my character and not the color of my skin guy, is the sum and substance of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was a radical leveler. He was a radical egalitarian, and that was his plan. Ladies and gentlemen, if that's a conservative viewpoint, I'd hate to see a liberal viewpoint.
And you look at all that the government has given to the minorities here in the times since King's death, and you would think that now, surely, they would at least admit, at least honestly admit, that they have... they receive equal access, if not preferential treatment, on anything and everything, whether it be job placement, job advancements, scholarships, you name it. They have really
all
a leg up.
In life.
Yeah, they have a leg up on European Americans across the board because of the insane policies and laws that have been enacted as a result of the so-called civil rights movement. Well, to my shock and amazement, as I was watching, flipping through more than watching, but I was flipping through television the other night, and I come across ESPN, and it's a SEC basketball game being played between Tennessee and Alabama. Now, I'm watching the game, and just like with most Division I NCAA basketball teams, it's about 90% black. And in fact, at the time I was watching, all 10 players on the court, five for both each team, they were all black, which is to be expected, I guess, in this day and age. Well, then it goes to and they're playing the game, and then it goes to halftime. And since this game was being played a couple of days after the King holiday, they have this big, long, what's the word I'm looking for, Keith?
Self-flagellation.
Yes, of King and how
beating themselves, gnashing their teeth, rending their garments, and pulling their hair out.
All
by
of that. This elaborate production, I guess, was what I was looking for. Elaborate production ESPN goes to about how the King dream is becoming realized, but there's still so much to go. And then they go on. If anybody watched this game, call in. This was played on Tuesday night, Tennessee at Alabama. ESPN, national television, they're talking, and they're being serious about the major problem, quote-unquote, that exists with blatant racism in college athletics. Blatant racism is still a huge problem, so says ESPN, in college athletics. And then I'm watching the game, and Everybody on the court, all those scholarship players are black, but yet they're still – the coaching staff is black for Alabama, but they're still – they still believe that that's not enough, that they haven't arrived, that they're still – even though they hold all the positions, there's still racism. Keith, I mean, that's so absurd. That is so disconnected from reality.
That people don't have eyes in which to see or brains in which to think. But, of course, again, you have to consider who the messenger is. Who dominates and controls ESPN? Why, of course, it's a Jewish elite again. Look at all the white announcers, the so-called white announcers. Chris Berman, Doug Gottlieb, Steve Levy, Rich Eisen, Rachel Nichols, Linda Cohn, Tony Kornheiser, yada, yada, yada. Of course, I don't see a Southern Baptist among them. And, of course, they're all Jewish. Now, you know, they continue to beat this drum, even though it's obviously a false tone. That you know, you just look, I guess your lying eyes are deceiving you when you see 10 out of 10 basketball players on the floor playing who are black, and that's not at all unusual. I guess they think they have new frontiers to conquer because now the coaches are going. For example, here in the Tennessee
area, we have a new Jewish coach
for Memphis State, Josh Pastner, and, of course, at University of Tennessee, Bruce Pearl.
That's right. Yeah, and those are two of the most premier programs in the country. But we're going to pick up on that. We're not done. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Remember, ladies and gentlemen, when you are listening to the voice of the American right, you are listening to the Political Cesspool radio program. Welcome back. I'm James. He's Keith. And we were finishing up a couple of thoughts on that ESPN theatrical production there of the halftime of the Tennessee-Alabama game. Keith, I mean, I guess the only way, I mean, what more do they want? I mean, what more could we do?
Well, you know, it's kind of crazy because, you know, everybody on the floor playing is black. The coaching staffs are increasingly non-white Gentile. And see, one of our problems is that when we see a white Jew, like Bruce Pearl or Josh Pastner, the coaches of the University of Tennessee and the University of Memphis, respectively, most people have been conditioned not to think in terms of Jew and Gentile and say, oh, a white guy's got the job, so everything's all right. But it's not. They're being squeezed out. And, of course, who is populating the stands? Who's cheering? Who's paying these expensive prices for popcorn and for tickets and for skyboxes and everything? None but the sports-addicted white Gentiles that are up there. You know, it's just it's kind of crazy. Could you imagine black people showing up and paying all this money to see a team of 10 whites play anything? Unless they were killing each other, maybe.
Well, I mean, you know, you're right about that, Keith, because I'm not obsessive, but I'll take in, you know, I think a very reasonable two or three sporting events a year. And I've gone to some NBA games. I'm a big NBA fan. I'll be honest about that. I like watching basketball. I played basketball in high school. I don't like some of the racial aspects of the game, but I'm a basketball fan, so I watch basketball, and there just aren't black people in the stands. You know, any blacks that are in the building, they're on the
players.
Yeah, they're on the bench. They're on the bench, but they're not in the stand. It's just amazing the disparity of whites in the crowd and non-whites. It's you know, 95% white. So once again, you know, if we're going to behave like the new Rome and be enamored in this culture of bread and circus, we're going to pay the price that Rome paid. But anyway, I saw that, had to bring it to everyone's attention.
Let me make this comment on the end. You know, why do we keep financing our own dispossession? You know, I've said before many times, the only sound a liberal fears is the sound of a closing purse. If we, white Gentiles, stopped going to these sporting events and it really interfered with the cash flow, there would be a change. But as it is right now, they have concluded that they can do anything. They can present any insult to the white Gentile population, and they'll enthusiastically lap it up. You know, it's just crazy. You know, I'm wondering if they'll even allow the janitorial positions to be held by white people in the future, you know, or are they going to be totally shut out?
Well, we'll find out, and it won't pay to find out if current trends persist. But, Keith, in the waning minutes that we have left in tonight's first hour, and keep in mind, this is just the first of three, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot more forthcoming tonight. Reverend Ted Pike in the third hour. Winston Smith's going to slide in here in Keith's chair in just a moment during the timeout we're about to have in a few moments. But we got to talk about Haiti. We talked about Haiti a little bit last week, and let me be clear, and it shouldn't even have to be said, but we don't find anything that's happening in Haiti funny. And, you know, there's nothing there that's going on that's good. But at the same time, there are some occurrences that are going on down there that we need to bring to your attention. And I was reading in the USA Today on, I guess it was yesterday, because I called you and told you about it, Keith, so it must have been Friday. I was reading in the USA Today, and they had some stories there about the just savage looting that's going on, and this one Haitian had found him a boom box, and he had broken in and gotten the boom box, and then he was immediately accosted by a gang of about 10 other Haitians who you know, wanted to kill him for the boom box, because, you know, you can eat a boom box, you can drink a boom box, so you can understand why they wanted it so bad. But, and then, you know, the police, what passes as their police force, they have to just, you know, shoot in the air and scare them off like wild dogs. And then I was reading that the American Marines are now obviously on the scene down there. And this is just, you know, the distribution points where the American Marines are bringing in food, the distribution points are being attacked. The Haitians don't even have enough sense or civilization to understand that you don't attack the people who are trying to bring in supplies and medicine to you. But I was reading the story specifically in the USA Today yesterday, and the American Marines had set up a little makeshift wall to keep the crowd orderly. And then the crowd sees these supply trucks coming in, and they start getting a little rowdy and a little bit unruly, and the American Marines have to put the clips into their rifles. And that quells the crowd for a minute, and then
Well, they did. They shot in the air, and that stopped them. And then when the crowd saw that they actually weren't going to shoot them, they said, to heck with them firing. You know, they're a bunch of paper tigers, and they started to attack the trucks, I understand. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Well, they saw that the trucks had beans in them, and they just went absolutely wild. And instead of waiting orderly for the beans to be, you know, given to them, I mean, this is ridiculous. For the beans to be given to them, they almost tumbled the wall over, and that would have obviously hurt or killed the Marines. Well, they had to trick them into, they revved up the engines of the trucks, the American Marines did, and acted as though they were going to take the beans away from them. And then the crowd understood that, you know, hey, if we don't settle down, they're going to take our beans away. So, and threatening to move the trucks, that did it. And then, you know, I guess they allocated the food there. But I was asking Keith yesterday, if the American military pulled out, if all of the first world nations withheld their aid and machinery to aid in the rebuilding of that so-called country, what would be the Haitians' plan of recourse? I said, well, thankfully, you know, our people have taken them communications technology. You know, they wouldn't have telephones or radio or anything like that if it wasn't for us. I said, I guess the best plan they would be able to come up with, God knows they're not going to have the capabilities to rebuild their infrastructure by themselves, so they would just get on the phones and the radios and complain about how, you know, America and France and Britain and everywhere else aren't taking care of them. But Keith said that's not what they do. What would they do, Keith?
Well, we've seen basically this is the heart of darkness, and they would probably revert to cannibalism, but we had talked the other day about a strange phenomenon that I think a lot of people aren't aware of called cargo cults. And this specifically refers to the what happened in Micronesia, Polynesia, and New Guinea during World War II, when first the Japanese and then the Americans came to these Stone Age people living in Stone Age circumstances and brought all these modern machines and conveniences and food and clothing and stuff that these people had never encountered before. And at first, they thought that the people that brought them, the Japanese and the Americans and the British, were gods. Then they realized that they were mortal. And when the war ended, all these goods, all this cargo, as you will, disappeared. So they started trying to somehow, through magic or rituals and whatnot, bring it back. They would, for example, build a mock airstrip and build an airplane out of bamboo and grass and go out and pretend like they would make a radio out of coconuts and stuff like this and pretend that they were on it. They would march around in some old uniforms that they saw, hoping that somehow this would provoke the gods into sending down parachutes of cargo, just like they'd seen happen during World War II with both the American and the Japanese armies when they were there. So, you know, and they're still doing stuff like that in certain parts.
See, I mean, that's almost science fiction, ladies and gentlemen, to think that there are people out there that still live this way. And God bless them. I mean, nothing against them. But to pretend that we're all interchangeable parts, to believe that there is no difference between the different peoples of this world is, well, it's just stupid. I mean, you know, to believe that people like that still exist, again, nothing against them, but that's
That's
unbelievable.
It's almost comical, but on the other hand,
I laughed when you first said, don't get me wrong, when you first told me that story, I laughed. I mean, I thought it was funny, but you know, this is in the year 2010. There are still people who do that kind of stuff, and I Haiti would be that place. It would be
Haiti is, quite frankly, if there's ever a need for a UN trusteeship or a protectorate for some, you know, white Western civilized nation or some group like that to control a nation because they're totally incapable of self-government, that area would be Haiti. Haiti has been the longest-standing black republic, and ever since they obtained their freedom from the European settlers that had founded the place and made it the jewel of the Caribbean, it's been synonymous with moral depravity, corruption, ignorance, poverty, and every other negative that you can imagine. And, you know, it's time to say, you know, the game is up. The only way that these people can, you know, exist in some modicum of civilization is for someone else to take charge of it.
Keith, that's it for the first hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
And Harv leaped to his feet and said, something's got a hold on me. Yow! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting, hallelujah! Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.